It's a party Albany. Let's have a big dash Albany. Let's celebrate now Albany. Another scandal Albany. That's what your vote is gonna get. Anytime you ain't seen nothing yet. We're going all the way at them.
Welcome, welcome to this edition live in the studio of What's Left in Albany. This program covers the built environment, politics, and people of Albany, as well as the surrounding Tri-City area and region, featuring discussions with leaders of community projects and their organizations, or leaders of organizations to discuss themselves and local issues in an effort to get the full picture of what's going on. I'm Dan Platt, your friendly neighborhood communist, interested in building eco-socialism and practicing direct democracy, waging my one-man clandestine insurgency against confusion and stagnation. Whatever the grievances or joys we share about our city, we are going to find whatever's left. No particular, let's see, the plan for this episode, cover more development stories as I always do, round off coverage of, I talked about bus station or particular a split with Trailways and Greyhound, so I wanted to get more info on that, though that's hard to come by. That isn't some kind of advertisement, you'll see. I'm going to talk about property taxation, one story that discusses its pitfalls and the issues that arise, and then a more comprehensive critique of them. Then, in the second half, probably. But first, a kind of, what is it called, sponsored content regarding, like, one of the reasons of why Greyhound, not Greyhound, but Trailways is severing its relationship with Greyhound. Now, I looked up, like, the other articles that came up were related to back in the early 90s when Trailways was basically going bankrupt and couldn't support its lines anymore, so I guess it was bought out by Greyhound. So I don't know how they've managed to go from subsidiary, maybe they're back to being independent, and that's what's really going on. This little piece of sponsored content from a site with the acronym Payments, so I'm assuming it has to do with financial tech and whatnot. The headline is Digital in the Driver's Seat as Trailways Severs Relationship with Greyhound. So, you know, that's what I typed in. This is one of the three things that came out. No particular person is credited this, so maybe it's AI-generated. After nearly a quarter of a century, Trailways of New York is ending its partnership with the Greyhound Bus Company as the family-owned firm pivots to a digital-first environment and looks to the future. So is it about ticketing? I have no idea. While Greyhound currently drives the bulk of intercity bus travel in the U.S., that's 1,200 buses taking 16 million passengers to 2,400 destinations, or nodes, Trailways has been part of that equation since 1998, according to, you know, a press release by Trailways. But the digital-first economy, driven in part by the pandemic, at least that's the narrative that tech companies like to go with, they're on the up and up, even though the economics behind them is actually showing its cracks, is something Trailways said it knew was something to pay attention to now and in the future. Quoting them, the CEO of Trailways, today nearly 80% of our customers are purchasing their tickets online, and of these customers, only over 70% are doing it on a mobile phone. As we've invested in a mobile-first online strategy and paperless ticketing, we've seen both of these stats rise. You know, does this have anything to do with why they don't need to be at an actual central bus terminal anymore? That's not what the story is really about. This is why I'm just saying maybe it's a part of it. I'm just trying to get some facts. Trailways said it is making a multi-million dollar investment in its websites, with the intention of enhancing the consumer digital-first experience. You know, the company is also striving to make digital improvements, like blah, blah. Dissolving the agreement between the two companies. So this is, okay, now we get back to their own booking program, as well as bring commuter pass ticketing online for the first time. Dissolving, this is quoting them again, dissolving the agreement between the two companies, Trailways and Greyhound, gives Trailways full control over their, basically their ticketing platform. They call it the end-to-end travel experience, allowing us to reaffirm our commitment to providing affordable, comfortable, and dependable transportation. He further added that Trailways' partnership with Greyhound limited their ability to adjust their scheduling based on need. Now, that could be code for, let's see, gouging, price gouging and such. But again, need data. Can make other improvements to, you know, meet other demands. So Greyhound spokesperson told Payments that the company is continuing to partner with Trailways, with the exception of Adirondack Trailways out of Kingston. We value our Trailways partnerships throughout the country and will continue to work closely with them to provide service throughout our network. We continue to operate in the same markets, and there is no market change at this time. So that's the end of that. The other thing isn't catching loading up, unfortunately, but it was basically about how there was a $1 million study on renovating the bus terminal downtown. So I was trying to find out if that was playing a part, you know, like how it would be renovated determines who's the main, like maybe it, at the moment it's being leased to Greyhound. That's what the last story I said mentioned. So it was like they were evicting Trailways. But then, of course, PR said, no, this, it's all on Trailways. Trailways is actually, you know, they want to get out from under the thumb of Greyhound. I can imagine that too. Maybe it's both. Speaking of downtown parking, this is a development story, Albany Business Review, from them, written by Michael DeMasi, other reporters or writers. Apartments atop Albany parking garage. Study will see if it's possible. They also had kind of a public input meeting 2 weeks ago. So this was published April 18th of last year. So I suppose they've done the study, found it's feasible. And I think they did the public input meeting this month to move forward. I saved this recently, I swear. So could the riverfront garage in downtown Albany be replaced with a new garage that includes upper floor apartments with river views? And how much would it cost? So for some context, the Albany Parking Authority owns several of the parking garages in downtown Albany. They manage the parking meters and other such facets, parking policy. They're a public authority, so they're separate from City Hall. They're not like a department of City Hall. They're their own entity, and that will get into play at the end of this. But it also means that they take out their own separate bonds for paying for garages maintenance, and as it will come up, replacement. And I dislike this arrangement because during I listened to a meeting, or at least a report back from the man who is in charge, and he does talk about parking as like this service they provide and will continue, like a similar facet of like when your paycheck comes from something, let's say it's a problem, you don't want that problem to go away, though. You know, to those who advocate or believe in or just kind of going along with a car-based society or car-based cities, that's more important in this context, car-based cities. But whether it's the city or the metro area, it's one and the same to me, or as far as transportation policy goes, there's no imperative, or the imperative is in maintaining the status quo. Not more mass transit. That would hurt parking because this is actually an entity that actually talked about the parking garages like they were businesses. Like they were like, you know, our business was hurt during the pandemic because less people were commuting into Albany. You know, it would be a problem if we had more remote work happening, especially with state commuters, state workers. And yeah, but you know, we have parking garages instead of apartment buildings and places where people live and work and do things. Now they're trying to do a little bit of both because the parking authority, they're meant to provide parking. to a downtown area that wasn't designed to be car-based. But it was like, well, if we're going to have a downtown and people need to be able to drive to it, that means, you know, we have to demolish half of it. Now, maybe because of preservation efforts and how old Albany is, we didn't demolish half of it like other cities. Like you go to Buffalo and other upstate cities, it's like half demolished, half parking lots, and there's, oh, there's plenty of parking, but not much city left. So let's continue with the text. And how could the new mixed-use facility be integrated with the historic Kernan Plaza, which is the former train station, turned office building that's next to the garage? So just the place which garage we're talking about here. This is also the one that's adjacent to the pedestrian bridge over the highway, 787. So those are some of the questions the Albany Parking Authority wants to answer. The authority is seeking proposals from consultants to do a feasibility study about the future of a two-story of their two-story 814-space garage. Built 38 years ago, the garage is structurally sound but getting more costly to maintain and repair. The normal lifespan of a garage, get this, is 30 years, says Matt Peter, executive director. So that's Matt Peter is his name. And this always blows my mind as someone who went to architecture school, and it blew my mind when I was basically shown a graph of the projected and expected lifespans of things like parking lots, houses, roads, bridges, and that they have a particular lifespan when compared to previous civilizational infrastructure that can last a century if maintained. Our infrastructure, housing, and cities are built to basically be replaced every 30 years. And that's expected to be paid for by what exactly? Well, the point is we can't, and that's why half our city gets demolished or blighted or deinvested, because it's just too expensive to replace everything every 30 years. At least that's my conclusion. So rather than demolishing the building and building a similar garage in its place, which is something that Matt Peter was talking about in this meeting a year ago, about like, well, we're coming up on their lifespan, we're talking about replacing them, which is also guaranteeing 30 years of the same parking regime where we expect the same amount of commuter traffic, the same amount of traffic deaths, and the same amount of car pollution, and the same amount of investment in all of our driving infrastructure instead of mass transit, instead of sustainable alternatives, et cetera, et cetera. Upper floor apartments, for instance, would have views of the Hudson River just beyond the interstate, which may have a lifespan as well, but would add to the growing number of new residential developments downtown. It would also make better use of the location in light of the study the state will be doing to reimagine the future of the highway, in which case make it a boulevard is the main thing you do when you de-highway a riverfront, as Seattle has done. And many cities have actually done, and nobody sheds a tear for the removed highway. Or at least, when I bring it up to others, I usually hear some complaints. It's always smart to look at your options, says Peter. So anyway, it's not possible to build floors on top of the existing garage because it wasn't designed to hold weight above it. A new garage costs $30,000. A new garage would cost $30,000 per space, which adds up to $31 million to replace the existing garage. Adding more floors would increase the cost between the projected 25 to 30%. You know, it's not too much more cost to build a four-story building than a two-one. The riverfront garage spans about three blocks, totals 246,000 square feet, but it's barely noticeable to people driving through downtown or on the highway as it's sandwiched between buildings on Broadway and Water Street, a road that runs parallel to the interstate. The garage is about 80% full, so it's not even fully used. The biggest customer is the Dormitory Authority, which is one of the blocks. The spaces are also used by the federal court for jury duty and private businesses in downtown Albany. During the summer, people park here for Live at Five shows at the riverfront because the garage is connected by ramp and elevator to the pedestrian bridge. A change enacted in state law last year, that's 2021 by way of the article, enables the parking authority to enter into public-private partnerships, such as one that would likely be needed to fund a a mixed-use development. So it's, they can do more than just provide parking if they let a private entity do the construction and the management of the apartments. A change in act, okay. So there's also, and the study itself will, is $100,000 grant from the Empire State Development, from Empire State Development. So here's my story, kind of the pitfalls of taxation, at least based on property, because it leads to sticky questions like, should Airbnbs be taxed as residential or commercial? When does, you know, rental property become a business? You know, when do you go from petty bourgeois to bourgeois, where you're just a big landlord, to a mom and pop or grandma renting a basement apartment? Okay, this is from Strong Towns. I've read them before on the Three Left show. By Sierra Shepherd. So most of us remember playing musical chairs as a kid. We grabbed the dining room chairs and set... Mentioning musical chairs. Care to... Okay, once the music did stop, the tense walk would turn into a race of who could plop down on the open seats first. Someone would always be left standing or sitting on the lap of another, since they moved too slowly or would be forced to sit out for the rest of the game. Maybe this is a metaphor for something. Many people have used the concept of musical chairs to relate to housing shortages in North America. We're all playing a game. Though it's a game of people's lives. But instead of a race to see who can sit down the fastest, it's usually centered around who can acquire the most cash flow and buy up the market. Never mind a right to housing or ensuring that we do not have homeless or houseless people. Imagine there's two potential homeowners and two potential homes. Person A has more cash than B and buys one of the available homes. Before Person B can save enough to purchase the second home, Person A decides to go ahead and then buy that one. Now Person A owns the entirety of the market. They decide to rent out the second property they purchased, maybe to B, but instead of creating a long-term rental that the second citizen could afford, they create a short-term one, such as an Airbnb, because that will ultimately create a higher cash flow. This is an overly simplified example of one version of housing musical chairs we citizens face in a housing market. It's not saying the short-term rentals are bad, although they should be limited to rooms in this commie's opinion, but merely another stone we must juggle in our capitalistic game of life. But let's take it a step further and examine short-term rentals past how they can potentially affect the housing market and how they play a role in contributing to local economies, like Albany's. Although we're not known for having a lot of Airbnbs yet, right? Maybe I should look into that. I'll do that after the article. Property taxes represent a large source of public revenue for local governments and pay for the majority of vital services. In North Carolina, public education, infrastructure, and safety are just a few of the categories covered by property taxes. A few weeks ago, Joe Mizukazi from Urban 3 presented to the Asheville-Burncobb County Ad Hoc Committee about property tax inequities riddled within the state, suggested some possible solutions on how to fix them. Urban 3 has been researching property tax inequities in North Carolina for over a year. Since 2012, the firm has been working to help, so I guess that's what Urban 3 is, a consulting firm. They've been working to help local governments take charge of their financial future with revealing visualizations, they make graphs, about basically how they're imaging money, or how property taxes are an incredibly terrible way of collecting tax revenue because it is outdated. It was created 200 years ago. We're using a 200-year-old tax system in a modern economy. Or a feudal tax system. Their work has expanded internationally, and they've received awards. Okay. One topic they dove into within their presentation was short-term rentals and how they're taxed. So here's a picture of a street in Asheville that when you pass by in your car, you assume it was a group of residential homes, but it's not. Each house on this block of roughly 15 homes or houses, each house on that block is an Airbnb. Some of which are rented up to almost $2,000 for a night, a staggering amount compared to local long-term rentals in Asheville, which have a reported medium two-bedroom rent of $1,700. There are two types of property tax an owner can be charged, commercial or residential. In North Carolina and other places in the U.S., Airbnbs are placed under the residential property tax bracket. Within this presentation, Minikazi questioned the legality of this reality in our current system. This is a difficult topic to tackle, especially when it comes to Airbnbs and other short-term rental services' ability to be diverse. One resident could rent out a room in their house, while another could rent out an entire house. It can also be a side income where a renter only opens their availability for a few days of the month, or a full-time income where the building is only used for the rental purposes. The conversation of how short-term rentals should be taxed isn't actually a new one. So in North Carolina, the general statutes outline a guidance on how the property tax should be determined. Each parcel is examined by looking at its advantages, location, zoning, so on. Concerning whether a property should be treated as commercial or residential, in his presentation, Minikazi outlined the idea of a resident and questioned what counts as one to create a residential property. Can a home-style property that is solely being rented out with no long-term in-house owners be considered a residential property? And how long would, say, a resident have to stay? Sort of how, like, residency requirements for a job or to serve an office. You know, it's like you need to be there at least half the year or something. Specifically concerning the street of Airbnbs, Minikazi argues that no, they cannot be considered residential because there are no residents residing there. They should be listed as commercial because the amount of revenue reaped from the property is equal to a commercial business. In fact, with a little Google searching, Minikazi discovered that most of these Airbnb properties on this street are listed under a business name, and the owners publicly display their home and residence to be in Florida, not any property listed in North Carolina. Why is it so important that we discuss this? It's important to ensure that each property is being assessed correctly, if you're a tax assessor, of course. But it's also someone if you care about public services. Otherwise, we run into a multitude of issues, such as the property tax burden being shifted from owners of larger and more expensive properties to people who own smaller and less expensive ones. We also have to think further down the line. Cities are responsible for managing resources, i.e. property, in a way that benefits shareholders, i.e. residents. And of course, I don't agree with framing any of this like it's, you know, Wall Street terminology. Cities are for people, not for just money-making, though it can be argued that cities exist for money-making or they exist because of money-making. Okay, then I guess we should all just decentralize to little towns. But that's long-term visioning. Post-capitalist visioning. If the state is potentially losing out on millions of taxable dollars because parcels have been incorrectly assessed, and it also goes on the other hand that if these aren't residential properties, there are more costs being incurred by the city, more traffic along the block of people coming in and out, or that there'll be other damages by people who don't live, you know, there on the block. But maybe that's the big argument, like, well, we're not creating more of a burden on the city, like commuters do. If the state is potentially losing out on millions of taxable dollars because parcels have been incorrectly assessed as residential when they perform as commercial, then who is that affecting? It's also worth considering that taxing short-term rentals more fairly may also end up leaving a few more homes on the long-term rental or purchase market, freeing up some much-needed chairs in our current experience of housing musical chairs. You know, the side of let's ensure there's enough chairs, who's paying for the chairs, are the chairs common owned? Are they all private owned so someone can take their chair away? You know, it's not really a game. So to continue on, more like talking about taxes or tax policy as a social thing, a CNN story linked by a Green Party congressional candidate, Steve Greenfield. He was on the school board in New Pulse and is still very active in that area. He's a part of a musician union and so on. I would read his stuff in the past on the Three Left show in years past. So I've had this saved a long time, let's check when this post was. June of 2021. So, you know, after the pandemic started, so not crazy old. But I didn't really have a good chance or opportunity to reread this. But it makes sense now since it is he's ranting about property taxes. So I think I'll read this first and then maybe go into the article and skip around rather than the other way around. Since I do have, you know, I'll just read his post. But the post is basically about white liberals who then get really racist when it comes to integrating their schools and getting into, you know, why desegregating schools is seen as some economic harm or other things like that. Let's see. Maybe I should read part of it. Let's see. Why integrated schools invoke so much resistance? And this matters in Albany because, like the rest of New York, we have very segregated school systems, or rather by district, which also follows housing segregation and how that's enforced by economic class. And thus, it's, you know, it's called racial capitalism in that these are market forces, but they are racialized because it's the legacy of, well, slave capitalism. When it comes to this issue, history doesn't inspire much confidence. And that's why much hasn't changed for what one scholar calls ground zero for racial equity or quality, schools and homes. Black Lives Matter signs are showing up on more white people's lawns today, but statistics suggest that these lives don't matter as much if more black people start sending their children to school with white kids. Public schools in America remain highly segregated, not just in the South, but in many blue states and progressive communities, which is why I don't like using that term, because it's meaningless. It doesn't mean anything, at least economically and socially and other things. I mean, not too much. The Economic Policy Institute, a nonprofit think tank, published a report this year that concludes that 60 years after the Supreme Court declared separate but equal schools unconstitutional, American schools remain heavily segregated by race and ethnicity. And again, and this goes to, since they're funded by property taxes, by the wealth that people who live near them have, this also makes them separate and unequal. Or not separate, but the schools are unequal. It's said that less than 13% of white students attend a school where a majority of students are black, while nearly 70% of black children attend such schools. It would be shoddy history to attribute all this failure to white Southerners. Resistance to busing in places like Boston in the early 70s was just as vicious as in the South, but Northern opponents of school integration used terms like forced busing to disguise their racial hostility. By and large, they would say they weren't racist, and they're not like the racists in the South, and that they were in fact liberal and voted Democrat, says DeMont. But when it came to their own backyard, they had a different perspective. These high levels of school segregation remain despite evidence that integration benefited both, well, all people, at the height of school desegregation from the 60s to 80s. High school graduation rates and test scores for black students improved during that era, 20 years, but integration also reduced racial prejudice, because when you actually know other different people, you know, you're not so hostile or you're not scared of different people. I put it one way. Once white parents have access to a school district that they feel is working well for their kids, then they try to do everything they can to create barriers around it to keep the resources for themselves and their very small number of peers. I mean, this is a natural thing to do in a competitive marketplace where there's a scarcity of good jobs and a scarcity of good housing created by musical chair games. Not all the resistance can be attributed to race. Some Howard County parents said they opposed the school redistricting plan because it would harm less affluent students who were primarily black and brown by forcing them to take longer commutes and lose longtime friends. Public meetings, many said they were Democrats and worked for nonprofit social justice groups, according to the New York Times story on the school redistricting fight. So let's jump back to Steve's comments on this, because he kind of goes, so you know why we never achieve either desegregation or economic equity? Because even when people publish these what good white people get wrong while trying their best to be anti-racist articles, they leap right over the elephant in the living room. Property taxes. to things that can't be achieved and assure resistance by pressuring equity as a zero-sum game that white people have to give up big things so non-white people can make any gain. Nobody has to give up anything but the rate at which their progress exceeds others. The economy grows faster than the population. All that needs to happen is to allow growth for everyone at equal rates and do some reversal of the policies that built the tripling of the wealth gap, obviously grossly favoring whites over the last 40 years, so that those forced to fall even further behind than they had already been can maybe catch up. Who came up with the meme that white people have to give things up in order for non-white people to progress? Who thinks promoting that idea is going to be embraced by enough people that a democracy can adopt policies that require a majority of the population to surrender what gives their own children their best shot at what they see as a financially secure future, you know, in the marketplace? But here's an even more crucial question. Why does this mathematically erroneous and politically impossible notion get all the liberal press? Could it be that conflict gets higher ratings and easing conflict? Do the people who own the principal public information platforms make more money when the problems of democracy persist and making sure that arguments and accusations continue and problems are never solved? Could it be that management, CNN, and Fox share the same motive and are incentivized to egg each other and their audiences on? This is a broader rant, I suppose, but it works. Poverty tax is in there. By far, and without any close second, what makes neighborhoods and towns segregated by income and by extension segregated by race is the carrying cost of a home, which is its tax burden. Towns build this carrying cost by providing high levels of services in categories that are paid by property taxes rather than income-sensitive taxes, such as schooling, policing, fire protection. Every time a town improves local services, it exacerbates segregation. As long as schools and other local services are paid by property taxes, succeeding at being a good local government means reducing access to people of color or the general poor. Even white poor people, even. This is insane. How can this be the basis of education and other public service delivery in a supposedly liberal state like New York, where every liberal politician must genuflect towards anti-racism to get elected, knowing that under no pressure to actually equalize opportunity of access to social mobility-promoting residents? Now, this goes back to, let's see, a general note that the Supreme Court of New York ruled that our inequity in funding schools is unconstitutional because it isn't in a constitution to provide a good education, and you can't do that while schools are underfunded in certain areas because the property tax base is too low. And the legislator has not done a damn thing. Still breaking the law. So that's the thing good white people and non-white people are getting wrong. But they will never stop getting it wrong because nobody is telling them it's happening. Busing started 50 years ago, and despite physically integrating a small percentage of schools, has done nothing to close income and net worth disparities, while doing much to inflame tensions, which are driven by as much by resistance to kids spending long periods of time on transport as by outright racist animosity. It's a 50-year record of failure. The best way to integrate schools is to integrate neighborhoods and towns, and the best way to do that is to make them affordable. This article gets it wrong yet again. Starting programs to import poor people into better-off areas by creating low-income housing is like busing another decades-old policy that has never closed any gaps and cannot close them, because people are always free to sell their home and move elsewhere, which is an interminably historical fact, unpleasant as it is. As its cause and the names we give to it. Maybe it's not like maybe this time white flight won't happen because white people are becoming more progressive or woke as a reasonable expectation. But if we eliminate the heaviest carrying cost of a home, housing immediately becomes affordable with no public expenditure or controversy. And by replacing it with income-sensitive taxes, A, the better off people pay their fair share, and B, there is no incentive for flight because there will be no protected areas. Everyone will just have to deal with it, but most won't mind because their property taxes will have been eliminated. which increases their actual property values as many more people become able to purchase their homes should they one day sell or need to collateralize a loan. Now, is Wi-Fi real? Of course it is, but a lot of it is driven by bad policy, not always because of inherent animus that drives white people to flee people of color. Why does nobody ever seriously discuss the obvious, which is to stop wasting time on expensive, conflict-inducing social engineering projects, as Greenfield puts it, that have never worked, gin up even more racial conflict or political gridlock by insisting that white people must surrender things, or insisting that white people is still a viable political category, but I'm adding that, in order for other people to thrive, just end property taxes or inequitable taxation. I mean, another example that always comes to mind is how we had, since 08, basically since the last big recession, 09, 08, New York put in the property tax circuit breaker. You know, people were sick of their property taxes being raised, let's put a cap on how much localities can raise their taxes to fund services, since, you know, the cost of services go up either by inflation or more population, but the tax base doesn't increase, so you have to raise the rate. Even though maybe incomes are going up, it's just assumed that, and this is going back to feudal times and the feudal tax system, why property tax is so old, it's assumed that if you have property, you're getting an income from that property. It's not adjusted for 20th century social democracy, where we had programs like the GI Bill, which allowed millions of actual working people purchase a home, or even on a low salary, a working class salary, you could save up and buy a home in the mid-century. That's when we should change tax policy. But, well, a lot of other things are going on, but even now, when it seems like, well, you know, maybe next term, maybe when it's safe, well, it's never safe. Instead, we have to put in a property tax circuit breaker so that if your property taxes are higher than your income, you get an exemption or something like that. This is aimed particularly for the retired, because the retired now being on a fixed income, but their property taxes would continue to rise since their taxes weren't tied to their income. They were tied to their property value. And so it's also assuming that people don't live long enough, especially if they're working people with a set pension aside, that they will, you know, die before this becomes a problem, that they would not age in place and live in the home that they bought and paid for, but have to pay a rent to the city just based on the value of their property, not based on what they're economically producing, which is usually your income, whether it's wages, but most particularly capital investment, which is more state and federal level stuff. But again, that has also been cut over and over and over. Oh no. Okay, so we got a bit more time, not enough for the longer piece that I had out, so let's just go back to more. Okay, so these two are related, I think. Both from the Business Review also. And also kind of telling a story, because they're probably your part as well. Let's see, April of 22, and this one I'm pretty sure is more recent. No, September of 22. Okay. So this one first. Both are from last year. One from April. And this is about the port and the offshore wind tower factory that's going to be built there. It's mostly federally funded. I think it's GE is going to be the main beneficiary of it. Public-private partnership. You know, we can't have state factories with unionized workforces. But GE can have more facilities. Well, they can be trusted with facilities on the Hudson River. going back to PCB dumping, another pollution that they really wiggled out of cleaning up. Port of Albany approves $43 million contract for offshore wind tower factory. So this is the beginning of it, or the announcement. They've been awarded with a $42 million, or about $43 million contract to, I'm sorry, they awarded the contract for building it to CDMG Building Systems, a company out of Pennsylvania, to supply four metal buildings along the Hudson River that will serve as the centerpiece of the nation's first offshore wind tower manufacturing plant. Our first one. Wow. This is after many countries have actually built their offshore wind facilities, like towers, fields of them offshore. We're just getting to the building of the factory to make them. The contract was awarded during a special meeting of the Port District Commission last week as officials raced to line up approvals and construct a factory to allow joint venture Merriman Wellcome to start producing wind towers and other parts by the end of the year. CDMG is expected to ship the first pre-engineered metal buildings to the Port of Albany. So these are factories, but they're pre-built buildings? Interesting. I know manufactured buildings are all over, and it's also kind of the future. It cuts down on construction costs to pre-build. Let's see, three buildings arriving in the fall, so maybe they're already in place. Located just south of Pittsburgh was one of the two companies to respond to the port's RPI, request for proposal. The other response was determined to be insufficient. The port unanimously approved the contract to lock in prices and ensure the buildings arrive on schedule. Buildings range to a size of 67,000 square foot building for assembly work, another 292,000 square foot building for welding and plate metal plates. Total amount of manufacturing, assembly, and office space is, the number is 590,000 square feet. The offshore wind tower factory will be located on 82 acres that the port acquired in Bethlehem in 2018. A separate 20,000 square foot building that was not part of this contract will be located on a 14 acre site, 700 Smith Boulevard in Albany. It is a pretty big milestone, said Port Chief Executive Rich Heinrich. Because of the aggressive schedule, it was important to get it done. Crews began clearing trees at the offshore wind tower factory location this month, and that work is nearly complete. And it got to destroy the environment to save it, right? I say sarcastically. A 970,000 contract for that work to William Keller & Sons Construction Corp. of Castleton. Now the port is optimistic that the Bethlehem Planning Board could grant final approvals for the factory next month. The factory is expected to employ 500 welders, electricians, general staff. It will be operated through a joint venture formed by a machining company, Marmon Incorporated of Quebec, and steel fabricator Wellcome of Denmark. Well, they have experience in putting up offshore wind. The plant will produce wind tower sections up to 33 feet in diameter, that's the rotor diameter, and 164 feet long. The complex will also manufacture transition pieces which connect the wind tower to the foundation. Those pieces will be 115 feet long. Now, of course, what's the lifespan of these pieces of machinery? Also about 20 to 30 years. The project is tied to the state's goal of constructing 9,000 megawatts of offshore wind along the Atlantic coast by 2035, which will maybe make up 5% of New York energy needs as they are now. As I will repeat over and over, reading net zero is all about reducing, making our economy more efficient, or reducing energy use 70%, and then offshore wind and other such things can make up that last bit, the last third, so to speak. But moving on to a little further into last year, so I did mention they were getting federal money, but actually this, I saved this one because, well, actually, no, that's not happening. Next headline, Port of Albany abandons $30 million federal grant to speed up construction of first UF offshore wind tower factory. Well, GE is supposed to be the prime manufacturer of wind turbines. They usually make the land-based ones, and apparently they don't make the ocean-bearing ones. But yes, why aren't U.S. corporations jumping on this? Why is it other countries have already done all of this, so it's more cost efficient to rely on them. The Port of Albany is walking away money on the table from a $30 million in federal funding, a move that will speed up construction. So they're giving them money, speed up construction, because I guess then they'd have to wait for the grant to come through or something. The speed up construction of that manufacturing complex I was last talking about. Port executives are withdrawing their grant application from the U.S. Maritime Administration, a move that shifts federal environmental oversight to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the National Marine Fisheries Service, which started their review 13 months ago. So does that mean if it was under the maritime and getting money from them, then I guess the review would take longer? But does that mean they get to cut corners? Our partners agree that timing is the most important issue here, said Megan Daly, the port's chief commerce officer. We are 4 months behind where we wanted to be. We need to make up that time, and we believe changing our strategy will allow us to get there. The $350 million project is being constructed by, as mentioned, Marin Welcon, Danish company, a joint venture between the companies from Quebec and Denmark. They will operate the proposed 590-square-foot facility at the Hudson River Port, producing wind towers and other components for Ecuador, which is the, I believe, state-owned Norwegian oil, gas, solar, and, well, the Norwegian energy company. They deal with all types of energy. Whole mix. Because it's nationalized there. Construction of the factory is expected to create, and mentions the jobs. However, the Port of Albany, which spent the last 3.5 years applying for permits to allow them to construct the factory, has faced headwinds in recent months. Ironically, those headwinds are tied to environmental and health concerns involving the project, despite the fact that the main product to be manufactured at the factory is supposed to help reduce the nation's reliance on fossil fuels and protect the environment by cutting down carbon emissions. But only carbon emissions. There's more types of pollution than that. Weeks after the Bethlehem Planning Board unanimously approved the site plan for the wind tower plant at the 82-acre property on Beacon Island, a group of residents from the nearby hamlet of Glenmont filed an Article 78 lawsuit asking a judge to nullify that. Quoting Lorraine Thompson, local homeowner, "We are mad as hell. Until this spring, we had no idea this project was going on." This is whose home is located just west of the complex. Thompson, 65, and 30 other neighbors are the plaintiffs for this Article 78 case, filed in state Supreme Court in Albany County 1 month after the planning board vote. Quote, "Residents provided mail written notice to residents within 200 feet, heard this before, but here the recipients of such notice are commercial owners. Not to provide such written notice to residential property owners within the impact area of 1 to 2 miles. For the present 80-acre project, with near and distant views and impacts, is not within the spirit of the law and the duties that a lead agency supervising the environmental impact statement process is mandated to follow." This is the, I guess, the brief from attorney Christopher Dempf of Tobin, and wrote in his complaint on behalf of Thompson and her neighbors. So this is the attorney hired by the neighbors. Dempf argues that the port, the town of Bethlehem, the planning board, and the zoning board of appeals neglected to take a hard look at several issues. This included noise, traffic, adverse visual impact, and potential disruption of fly ash, waste from coal-fired furnaces that was dumped on the site years ago. So this is brownfield stuff. In court filings, the port and its legal team have denied all claims, among those who filed affidavits objecting the case, blah, blah, blah. Go jump ahead, running out of time. It's not skipping too much. The port's goal is to work with labor unions and its construction manager, Gil Blaine Building Co., to ensure the complex is up and ready to hand over the keys to the foreign companies so they can begin installing equipment at the end of this year of 2023 or early 2024. Port officials believe they are able to work with them to find a way to make up for the $30 million in federal funding that we'll no longer receive to help finance the project. So maybe they have to walk away from it because of this lawsuit. We are committed to do what we need to do to make the project work. Daly, the port's chief commerce officer. Let's see. Port officials are hoping, this is one of the paragraphs I skipped, the slowdown occurred when oversight from the federal permitting process shifted about 9 months ago from the Army Corps of Engineers to the Maritime Administration. Withdrawing the application for the $30 million is expected to get things back on track. There's been no construction on the site since April. That's when the last article I read was written. Port officials are hoping they can resume site work early November. That's already passed. The next phase will include removing stumps and installing a cap to contain the fly ash that was dumped on the property years ago. You know, it's, they're not cleaning it. They're capping it. That's always a recipe for future. That causes problems later. Officials from Riverkeeper, a nonprofit environmental group dedicated to protecting the Hudson, also raised concerns about the port expansion. The organization, whose president was not available for comment, claims the port did not have the proper permits in place when it cut down, well, when it basically deforested the island that they're building it on. Port officials have said they adhere to all requirements under federal, state, and local regs. Of course, if these regs are not up to snuff, then damage is still damage. So, if you want a longer kind of broader conversation about this whole, like, you know, green energy versus more comprehensive environmental goals, I have several episodes of the Three Left Show that discuss that. One is called Planet of, well, it's about the Planet of Humans documentary. And I cover other episodes that involve greenwashing and how we need to go far beyond that. So, with 1 minute left, let me get back to the list. Okay, my outro. This is the show for the week. Please contact me to leave feedback, suggest topics, or join me on the program using my socials, which are on Facebook, Twitter, and Mastodon. So that's What's Left in Albany / Three Left Show. Instagram at Dan J. Platt, P-L-A-A-T. And the general website for both shows, but it's named for Three Lefts, www.threelefts.news. This is the website with info, show notes, and the archive of all episodes for both programs. Three Left Show is my leftist theory show where I discuss the strategies, practice, and issues of leftist politics. So otherwise, I want to wish you all well and encourage all listening to devote some time every week to a collective or community project as we discover what is actually left in Albany.
Let's have a party, Albany. Let's have a big bash, Albany. Let's celebrate now.